Riley, we have almost reached Jefferson's ideal. When draft opinions are completed, they are sent to the print shop in the basement, set in type, and proofs run. The proofs are carefully numbered, so that no set can stray and opinions thereby leak to the outside world. These drafts are circulated among the court, and comments come back to the author of the opinion from the other justices. Occasionally, at this stage, minds change. The justice assigned the opinion may find after research that he cannot support the reasoning he suggested at conference. A new majority may then form behind his revised views, or the opinion may be reassigned. Dissenting drafts may change votes, sometimes enough votes to convert the minority to the majority. Exchanges of view by memoranda, new drafts, and personal discussion continue until everyone is as nearly satisfied as is possible in the limited time available. The working papers of Justice Brandeis that were preserved include the 34th printed draft of one of his opinions. Inevitably, in trying to please 8 editors, the author of the majority opinion finds himself removing much of the personal flavor from his product. The dissenter, on the other hand, as Chief Justice Hughes said, can express his individuality. He is not under the compulsion of speaking for the court, and thus of securing a majority. In dissenting, he is a freelance. Hughes went on, and he might have been speaking of Justice Black's opinion in Betts v. Brady, a dissent in a court of last resort is an appeal to the brooding spirit of the law, to the intelligence of a future day, when a later decision may possibly correct the error into which the dissenting judge believes the court to have been betrayed. But this whole process of discussion, voting, and opinion writing is entirely concealed from public view. No one but the justices and their law clerks, and some printers equally dedicated to secrecy, have any idea how a case is going to come out until, on some Monday, the opinions are announced. There are also no news leaks at the Supreme Court, one of its many distinctions from all other Washington institutions. Not even the date of decision can be accurately estimated. It may come just a few weeks after argument, or many months. For the parties to a case, and their lawyers, the period between argument and decision is a time of frustrating puzzlement, of might-have-beens, of daydreams and nightmares. 2 months after the Gideon argument, at the beginning of March, 1963, Bruce Jacob was still thinking about the strangeness of that day. "It was so different from the Florida Supreme Court," he told a visitor. "They weren't concerned with precedents. They didn't ask you about existing law. Instead of asking about cases the way judges usually do, what did this case stand for, what did that case, they had all those hypothetical questions, trying to carry everything to its farthest point. I wanted to be honest. When they asked me whether there were some prisoners in Rayford, the state penitentiary, who should have had counsel, I had to say yes, because I had read some records and I knew there were. But the more honest I was, the more they kept putting me on the spot. Some of the questions were just designed to embarrass our position. I never had judges make your side look as bad as it could. I had been working on this thing for months, but some of the questions were completely surprising. You could tell that they knew what they were doing, that they were awfully smart men, that they had the benefit of the best thinking of the country." Jacob had no doubt, now, that the court would overrule Betts v. Brady. He wondered who was writing the court's opinion. It might have been assigned to some relatively neutral figure, like Justice Stewart, but Jacob thought not. He was sure Chief Justice Warren would give Justice Black the satisfaction of writing into law his dissent of 21 years ago. Jacob was still worried about the consequences of establishing an absolute right to counsel. He hoped especially that the court would limit its decision to future application, so as not to affect all those thousands of current prisoners. "It's easy to think of them as heroes," he said, "but after you've worked in the Attorney General's office, you know they're not. They're liars. They're terrible." He paused for a moment, thinking, and then added, "It's funny. At law school, I was the chairman of legal aid." Jacob noted that the case would probably have a different name when the Supreme Court decided it. The party against whom Gideon had originally brought his habeas corpus action, H.G. Cochran, Jr., had resigned as director of the Florida Division of Corrections and been replaced by Louis L. Wainwright. The court had been informed of the change, and Wainwright would, therefore, have the doubtful distinction of sharing Gideon's place in the title of an important legal decision. It was only a few days later, as it happened, that Gideon v. Wainwright was decided. There was no prior notice. There never is. The court gives out no advance press releases and tells no one what cases will be decided on a particular Monday, much less how they will be decided. Opinion days have a special quality. The Supreme Court is one of the last American appellate courts where decisions are announced orally. The justices, who divide on so many issues, disagree about this practice, too. Some regard it as a waste of time. Others value it as an occasion for descending from the ivory tower, however briefly, and communicating with the live audience in the courtroom. Techniques of opinion reading vary, too. Justice Frankfurter never looked at his text, but would expound from memory. Once Chief Justice Warren irritatedly accused him of saying things that were not in the opinion. Others stick closely to the text, and some read brief summaries. Justice Black's technique seems to vary with the opinion. He gives fuller and more emotional treatment to those he regards as of particular importance. The reading always begins with the most junior justice who has an opinion that day. On Monday, March 18th, that was the newest member of the court, Justice Goldberg. For a 5-4 majority, he held that Washington State had not made an adequate trial record available to two indigent prisoners for purposes of their appeal. The next case was unanimous. An opinion by Justice Stewart struck down an Indiana rule allowing the public defender to block a prisoner's appeal as worthless. Then Justice Brennan, for a 6-3 majority, broke important new ground in federal-state relations by holding that federal courts have the power to release on habeas corpus state prisoners who failed to follow regular state procedures. The result was to free Charles Noya of New York, whose two co-defendants in a murder trial had eventually been freed on a finding that confessions had been coerced from all three, but who had not himself appealed originally and had been turned down by the New York courts when he tried to appeal later. A fourth state criminal case came from California, and Justice Douglas, for a 6-3 majority, said poor prisoners were entitled to free counsel for their appeals. To any informed listener, it was obvious that the same rule must apply at trials, and that Betts v. Brady was about to be overruled. Those who had before them the printed opinions in the California case, page boys bring them around to a few newspaper reporters and the Solicitor General as they read, knew from the text that they were about to hear the Gideon case decided, because there was a reference to Gideon v. Wainwright decided today. The string of criminal cases was interrupted by a Douglas opinion on the Georgia county unit system of tabulating primary election votes to give extra weight to voters in rural areas. An 8-1 majority, Justice Harlan dissenting, held this discrimination unconstitutional. Then, in the ascending order of seniority, it was Justice Black's turn. He looked at his wife, who was sitting in the box reserved for the justices' friends and families, and said, "I have for announcement the opinion and judgment of the court in number 155, Gideon against Wainwright." Justice Black leaned forward and gave his words the emphasis and the drama of a great occasion. Speaking very directly to the audience in the courtroom, in an almost folksy way, he told about Clarence Earl Gideon's case and how it had reached the Supreme Court of the United States. "It raised a fundamental question," Justice Black said, "the rightness of a case we decided 21 years ago, Betts against Brady. When we granted certiorari in this case, we asked the lawyers on both sides to argue to us whether we should reconsider that case. We do reconsider Betts and Brady, and we reach an opposite conclusion." By now, the page boys were passing out the opinions. There were four, by Justices Douglas, Clark, and Harlan, in addition to the opinion of the court. But none of the other three was a dissent. A quick look at the end of each showed that it concurred in the overruling of Betts v. Brady. On that central result, then, the court was unanimous. Justice Black began reading sections of his opinion. Since 1942, it said, the problem of the constitutional right to counsel in state criminal trials had been a continuing source of controversy in both state and federal courts. A footnote cited articles by Professors Allen of Chicago and Kamisar of Minnesota. Justice Black, quoting briefly from the transcript of Gideon's trial, said Gideon had conducted his defense about as well as could be expected from a layman. The way the whole case had developed, he said, was strikingly like what had happened in the Betts case. Since the facts and circumstances of the two cases are so nearly indistinguishable, we think the Betts v. Brady holding, if left standing, would require us to reject Gideon's claim that the Constitution guarantees him the assistance of counsel. The rest of Justice Black's 10-page opinion was an assault on Betts. There was no attempt to show that overruling was required by developments in the 2 decades since the case was decided. It had been wrong to start with. Justice Black did not press his own theory that the 14th Amendment incorporated the Bill of Rights verbatim. He accepted as the law, for purposes of this case, the Cardozo formulation that particular guarantees of the Bill of Rights, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, had been brought within the 14th Amendment by a process of absorption, and thus had been made applicable to state proceedings. "We accept," he wrote, "Betts v. Brady's assumption, based as it was on our prior cases, that a provision of the Bill of Rights which is fundamental and essential to a fair trial is made obligatory upon the states by the 14th Amendment. We think the court in Betts was wrong, however, in concluding that the 6th Amendment's guarantee of counsel is not one of these fundamental rights." 10 years before Betts v. Brady, this court, after full consideration of all the historical data examined in Betts, had unequivocally declared that the right to the aid of counsel is of this fundamental character. Powell v. Alabama, 287, U.S. 45, 68, 1932. While the court at the close of its Powell opinion did by its language, as this court frequently does, limit its holding to the particular facts and circumstances of that case, its conclusions about the fundamental nature of the right to counsel are unmistakable. Justice Black mentioned other early cases that had emphasized the importance of counsel, including his own 1938 opinion in Johnson v. Zerbst, construing the 6th Amendment to require counsel in federal criminal trials, and concluded that Betts had made an abrupt break from these precedents. "Not only these precedents, but also reason and reflection," he wrote, "require us to recognize that in our adversary system of criminal justice, any person haled into court who is too poor to hire a lawyer cannot be assured a fair trial unless counsel is provided for him. This seems to us to be an obvious truth. Governments, both state and federal, quite properly spend vast sums of money to establish machinery to try defendants accused of crime. Lawyers to prosecute are everywhere deemed essential to protect the public's interest in an orderly society. Similarly, there are few defendants charged with crime, few indeed, who fail to hire the best lawyers they can get to prepare and present their defenses. That government hires lawyers to prosecute, and defendants who have the money hire lawyers to defend, are the strongest indications of the widespread belief that lawyers in criminal courts are necessities, not luxuries. The right of one charged with crime to counsel may not be deemed fundamental and essential to fair trials in some countries, but it is in ours." The opinion came to an end without any mention of the difficult problems of the scope of the decision. What kinds of criminal cases it covered, if any, apart from felonies? At what stage of the proceeding counsel was required? Whether the decision applied to persons already in prison, so that those who had not had counsel must now be given new trials? All those questions were presumably left to be answered when raised specifically by later cases. "The court in Betts v. Brady," Justice Black concluded, departed from the sound wisdom upon which the court's holding in Powell v. Alabama rested. Florida, supported by two other states, has asked that Betts v. Brady be left intact. 23 states, as friends of the court, argue that Betts was an anachronism when handed down, and that it should now be overruled. We agree. The judgment is reversed, and the cause is remanded to the Supreme Court of Florida for action not inconsistent with this opinion. Justice Douglas, while joining Justice Black's opinion, was not content to let the occasion pass without re-arguing the old proposition that the 14th Amendment incorporated all the Bill of Rights. "Unfortunately," he wrote in his concurring opinion, "it has never commanded a court. Yet, happily, all constitutional questions are always open, and what we do today does not foreclose the matter." Justice Clark did not accept the reasoning of Justice Black and the majority. In his concurring opinion, he rested on the fact that the court had already established an absolute right to counsel in cases involving the death penalty, even under Betts v. Brady. He drew the parallel with the overseas court-martial cases. In his own 1960 opinion on that subject, he said, the court specifically rejected any constitutional distinction between capital and non-capital offenses as regards congressional power to provide for court-martial trials of civilian dependents. He must conclude likewise here. The 14th Amendment requires due process of law for the deprival of liberty just as for deprival of life, and there cannot constitutionally be a difference in the quality of the process based merely upon a supposed difference in the sanction involved. Justice Harlan also followed a legal path of his own. "I agree that Betts v. Brady should be overruled," he said, "but consider it entitled to a more respectful burial than has been accorded. At least," he added in a respectful gesture to Justice Black's consistency of position for 21 years, "on the part of those of us who were not on the court when that case was decided." Justice Harlan could not agree that Betts had broken with precedents looking toward an absolute right to counsel. Powell v. Alabama had rested on the special circumstances of the Scottsboro trial, and Betts had actually enlarged the right to counsel by indicating that it could exist even in a non-capital case where there were special circumstances. But the special circumstance doctrine, Justice Harlan continued, had had a troubled journey. It had been abandoned altogether in death cases. In non-capital cases, it had continued to exist in form, while its substance has been substantially and steadily eroded. The court had not found a lack of special circumstances in any case heard and decided since Quicksall v. Michigan in 1950. The court has come to recognize, in other words, that the mere existence of a serious criminal charge constituted in itself special circumstances requiring the services of counsel at trial. In truth, the Betts v. Brady rule is no longer a reality. This evolution, however, appears not to have been fully recognized by many state courts, in this instance charged with the front-line responsibility for the enforcement of constitutional rights. Here, Justice Harlan cited in a footnote the recent Pennsylvania decision mentioned by both Fortas and the Civil Liberties Union, upholding the trial without counsel of a high-grade moron. The opinion went on, "To continue a rule which is honored by this court only with lip service is not a healthy thing, and in the long run will do disservice to the federal system. The special circumstances rule has been formally abandoned in capital cases, and the time has now come when it should be similarly abandoned in non-capital cases, at least as to offenses which, as the one involved here, carry the possibility of a substantial prison sentence. Whether the rule should extend to all criminal cases need not now be decided. This indeed does no more than to make explicit something that has long since been foreshadowed in our decisions." That was the end of Clarence Earle Gideon's case in the Supreme Court of the United States. The opinions delivered that Monday were quickly circulated around the country by special legal services, then issued in pamphlets by the Government Printing Office. Eventually, they appeared in the bound volumes of Supreme Court decisions, the United States reports, to be cited as Gideon v. Wainwright, 372 U.S. 335, meaning that the case could be found beginning on page 335 of the 372nd volume of the reports. Justice Black, talking to a friend a few weeks after the decision, said quietly, "When Betts v. Brady was decided, I never thought I'd live to see it overruled." Chapter 13. When a friend telephoned from Washington to give him the news of the decision, Bruce Jacobs said, "It's only the beginning." And it was. "Even if Betts v. Brady should be overruled tomorrow," Justice Stewart said in 1960, "there is no way that the Supreme Court could, or indeed that it properly should, see to it that in the day-to-day administration of criminal trials throughout the country, truly adequate representation of indigent defendants were provided. That job was up to the bar and the courts and the legislatures of the country." The Supreme Court had sounded a trumpet. The response had to come from society. 25 years before, in Johnson v. Zerbst, the Supreme Court had laid down the rule that federal criminal defendants had an absolute right to counsel, but society had been slow in responding. Despite the urging of every attorney general in that period, Congress had done nothing whatsoever to provide funds or establish any system of assuring counsel for the poor, except for a District of Columbia legal aid measure passed in 1960. And so, in 1963, federal judges still used their own random methods to appoint counsel, who had to serve without pay, without even compensation for out-of-pocket expenses. The result of this non-system, as might be expected, was inadequate representation for many defendants and a wholly unfair burden on a few lawyers. James V. Bennett, for many years the director of the federal prison system, told Congress on May 20, 1963, that his observations over 25 years had convinced him that the use of unpaid assigned counsel for indigents too often resulted in inept, hasty, and perfunctory representation. One of the many horrible examples cited by Mr. Bennett from his own experience was that of an 18-year-old girl who waived the right to counsel, pleaded guilty to stealing a letter from the mails, and was committed to the penitentiary for 5 years. "We found that she had an IQ of 45, and that her behavior was that of an impulsive child," Mr. Bennett said. "There was no question but that she was mentally incompetent, both at the time of the offense and at the time of trial. In my opinion, an experienced public defender or conscientious assigned counsel would have known immediately upon talking to her that she could not intelligently waive her right to counsel. He would have had her examined, and he would have presented to the court the information that she belonged in a state institution for the mentally defective, rather than in a court of the United States charged with crime." Senator Sam J. Ervin of North Carolina, writing in the American Bar Association Journal shortly after the Gideon decision, cited, among other examples, a Wyoming lawyer, in practice by himself, who was appointed defense counsel in a major federal criminal prosecution. There were 10 days and 3 nights of actual trial time, plus extended preparation. The government called 114 witnesses. "For practical purposes," Senator Ervin said, "the lawyer was required to close his office for 6 weeks. As a result, he was practically bankrupted." Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, testifying on May 22, 1963, spelled out the problem. "Federal courts today continue to delegate the defense of the underprivileged to assigned counsel who are not paid for their services. They are not reimbursed for their out-of-pocket costs. They do not receive a shred of investigative or expert help. They are not appointed until long after arrest, when witnesses have disappeared and leads grown stale. They often lack the trial experience essential for a competent defense." On the last point, the competence of assigned counsel, Mr. Kennedy quoted from a national survey undertaken by the Harvard Law Review. It concluded that the responsibility for representation of indigents in the federal courts now necessarily fell mainly on young, inexperienced lawyers, little versed in the technicalities of the criminal law, and that the quality of representation under these circumstances was largely fortuitous. 2 years before the Gideon decision, Attorney General Kennedy appointed a committee of scholars, practicing lawyers, and state and federal judges to review the adequacy of provisions for the indigent in federal courts. The chairman was Professor Allen, then at the University of Michigan Law School. He returned to Chicago in September 1963, whose law review analyses of Betts v. Brady had been so devastating. The committee proposed comprehensive legislation similar to, but more complete, than bills that had previously been considered. In summary, the proposal was as follows. Every federal district court would be authorized and required to choose one of four systems for representation of needy defendants. 1. Assigning members of the private bar, but, for the first time, compensating them modestly for their time and expenses. 2. Hiring a full-time or part-time public defender and staff. 3. Using counsel supplied by a local legal aid society or other legal organization, which would in turn be paid out of federal funds for providing their services. 4. Adopting any combination of these first three approaches. Such local option would permit accommodation to the great differences between federal courts in urban areas with a large volume of criminal cases and those in the country, where criminal trials are a relative rarity. Those eligible for assistance under the legislation would be persons financially unable to obtain an adequate defense. Services would deliberately not be limited to the technically indigent, since the man of modest means may need help in defending against a major criminal charge. Defendants would be required to pay whatever they could afford. Counsel would be provided from the moment a defendant is first brought before a judge or commissioner for preliminary hearing, shortly after arrest, and would continue through appeal. There would be funds for investigation, experts, and other services. President Kennedy submitted the Allen Committee measure to Congress as the proposed Criminal Justice Act of 1963, just 10 days before the decision in Gideon. It had the important support of the American Bar Association and of the Judicial Conference of the United States, representing all the federal courts. But it faced suspicion and resistance from Republicans and some Southern Democrats in the House of Representatives. The House had always been the sticking point. 3 times in previous years, the Senate had passed measures to provide some kind of compensated system for representation of the needy in federal courts, but no bill had ever even emerged from the House Judiciary Committee. The Senate again acted promptly in 1963, approving a slightly modified version of the Allen Committee proposal. In the House, a bill emerged from the Judiciary Committee for the first time, but with the option of public defenders struck out and a limit of $500 put on the compensation to be paid any lawyer in a felony case, $300 in a misdemeanor. The House passed the bill on January 15th. The necessary conference to reconcile the two versions was delayed by the congressional struggle over civil rights, but only this hurdle stood in the way of a historic first step by Congress to assist in the defense of the indigent. The Gideon case thus coincided with and encouraged an outpouring of concern and activity on the problem of representation in the federal courts. The question was whether it would take as long on the state level from what Bruce Jacob had called the beginning, the Declaration of the Right to Counsel in Gideon v. Wainwright, to an effective working system of justice for the poor in all 50 states. The problem was both larger and more difficult than in the federal judicial system. Criminal prosecutions by the federal government are only a handful compared to the number brought by state and local governments, which retain the primary responsibility under the Constitution for maintaining domestic peace and security. The typical state or local prosecution, moreover, for such a crime as theft or assault or disorderly conduct, is more likely to involve a deadbeat, down-and-out defendant. The proportion of indigents among state criminal defendants is higher, about 60%, compared to 33% in federal courts. Even among those intimately concerned with the problem of counsel for the poor, there is disagreement over the proper approach, especially as to the proper division of responsibility between the state and the bar. Whitney North Seymour, an eminent New York lawyer who heads the American Bar Association's Special Committee on Counsel for the Indigent, said in a 1963 speech that representation was a public responsibility. Just as doctors are not expected to provide all the facilities for dealing with illness of the poor, he said, lawyers cannot be expected to bear all the burdens of the decisions of prosecutors to prosecute the indigent. These are not obligations imposed by the Constitution upon the bar alone. They are obligations imposed by the Constitution upon the operation of our system of criminal justice. They are as much a part of the public obligation to support that system as the provision of courthouses, judges, attendants, and prosecutors. One way for society to meet the responsibility is through public defenders paid by the state. First tried in Los Angeles in 1913, defender offices now exist in 13 states, though only in the largest cities of some. They handle 100,000 cases a year. The great advantage of a public defender is that he can match the prosecutor in experience and knowledge of judges, juries, and trial tactics. The typical American lawyer has had only the briefest acquaintance with criminal law at law school, and none at all in practice. He tends to look down on the criminal bar as a collection of grubby characters who cannot make a go of it in the more remunerative corporate practice. Even a dedicated and obviously talented lawyer with criminal practice, such as Edward Bennett Williams of Washington, is regarded with some suspicion. Because the typical lawyer is nurtured in this tradition of distaste for criminal practice, and has had little or no experience of it, he cannot be expected to perform with great efficacy when he finds himself appointed defense counsel. This is a strong argument for public defenders. But the argument can be turned around. If, somehow, the body of American lawyers could be brought actively into the criminal courts, there to participate in the defense of the needy, the practice of criminal law might be elevated, the typical corporate lawyer might be educated in social responsibilities, and the gap in the profession might be narrowed. In England, any barrister may find himself appearing in a civil case one day, a criminal case the next. That is not likely here, but some thoughtful lawyers and judges believe a thoroughgoing involvement of the bar in defense of the indigent would be a healthy step for the profession. Another argument against public defenders is that their position on the public payroll will prevent them from fighting the prosecution as fiercely as private counsel. Communities that have experience with defenders, such as California, deny this, but an understandable feeling remains that a man in trouble will be better served by someone wholly concerned with him in a private relationship. There is also concern about the possibly deadening, conformist, bureaucratic effect of governmental control over any activity. Some of these feelings probably underlay a speech by Justice Clark in July 1963. He called for an urgent response to the demands posed by the Gideon case, but said he did not support the view that we must create a vast public defender system. Let us place this function in private hands rather than with the government. The indigent is entitled to private counsel. On the other hand, it is widely recognized that private counsel cannot do an adequate job if rushed into a case without preparation and given no financial support. And that is the customary situation. Chief Judge J. Edward Lombard of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has painted the picture. When advised that an indigent needs counsel, the judge usually picks out some lawyer who happens to be in the courtroom. The lawyer then spends a few minutes with his new client at the side of the courtroom, or perhaps in an anteroom under the scrutiny of the bailiff or the marshal. In most of such assignments, after a few minutes of conference, the defendant is advised to plead guilty, and he feels he has no choice but to do so. This mock assignment of counsel and the cursory hurry-up job of a busy, uncompensated lawyer makes a farce of due process of law and our Bill of Rights. Everyone who participates in the farce knows this, the judge, the district attorney, the assigned lawyer, the bailiff, and, of course, the defendant himself. In the view of Seymour and other experts, there is no decent alternative in populous urban areas to an office that has a regularly employed staff of lawyers representing indigents in criminal cases. The office could be that of a public defender or, alternatively, a voluntary legal aid organization. In New York City, for example, the Legal Aid Society provides counsel in 60,000 criminal cases a year. But the Society has had to go outside the organized bar for financial support, to private citizens and business for donations, and finally to the city treasury for an appropriation. Thus, experienced observers believe that some governmental participation is essential in the big cities that have the real problems of poverty and crime. Despite their differing emphasis on the proper role of government, Seymour and Justice Clark, in their 1963 appraisals, agreed that existing informal arrangements for appointment of counsel were inadequate. They were in general agreement on some practical steps to be taken. The young lawyer should be exposed to the criminal law and given experience in it. Justice Clark suggested privately financed internships for just graduated lawyers to let them learn while helping in the defense of the needy. Seymour proposed appointment of a senior lawyer and a junior assistant in more serious cases. Where there is no regular defender system, counsel should be appointed from rotating lists of all members of the bar, so that the burden is spread. Funds must be provided for investigation, and at least modest compensation for the practitioner who has no large law firm to back him up while he does good works. To that extent, at least, minimal provision of public funds for the assigned lawyer, governmental support would seem to be an inescapable element in adequate defense of the indigent. Many states now provide nothing. Thus, the process of converting the ideal of Gideon V. Wainwright into reality necessarily involved the participation of legislators, lawyers, judges, and citizens across the country. This process got underway with surprising speed immediately after the Gideon decision. Some of the members of the Supreme Court themselves took every opportunity to preach the gospel of Gideon. A month after the decision, Justice Clark called Gideon an historic case, one that would possibly have more physical impact on the administration of justice than any decided by the court. He urged law schools to upgrade the study of criminal law, and suggested that state and local bar associations undertake their own programs for criminal representation with a paid staff and panels of available lawyers. He urged individual lawyers to volunteer more readily for service to the poor. If each lawyer handled only a case or two a year by appointment in the criminal courts, the burden could be carried for the time being. He said it was imperative that the bar evidence a more active concern. Other members of the court sounded similar themes. Chief Justice Warren, talking to a luncheon of the Conference of Judicial Councils in May, said the Gideon case would amount almost to a revolution in some states. He called representation of the indigent a public responsibility that society should bear through orderly systems worked out locally. Whatever expense the states were put to, the Chief Justice said, they would be repaid not only in fairer treatment of the unfortunate, but in criminal courts that would work more efficiently and effectively with lawyers' help. At the time Gideon's case came to decision, several legal organizations launched the broadest attack in this country's history on the problem of legal services for needy criminal defendants. The Ford Foundation made grants totaling $2,540,000 for a series of projects. The largest part of this sum, $2,300,000, went to the National Legal Aid and Defender Association to establish model defender services in 6 or 8 counties, improve existing services in several major cities, and create new law school techniques of preparation for criminal law work. The American Bar Foundation was given $125,000 for a detailed survey of existing state and local systems of representation to be carried out in cooperation with state bars and with the special committee, headed by Mr. Seymour, of the Bar Foundation's parent, American Bar Association. At the same time, the federal courts undertook their own first study of what the typical appointed counsel actually does in a federal criminal case. The Institute of Judicial Administration in New York received a grant of $115,000 to continue a noteworthy experiment in the release of impoverished criminal defendants without bail. This study, carried out by the Vera Foundation, had already indicated that men so released were as likely to turn up for trial as those who had posted bond. The reaction of the states to Gideon v. Wainwright was swift and constructive. The most dramatic response came from Florida, whose rural-dominated legislature had so long refused to relieve the problem of the unrepresented indigent such as Gideon. Shortly after the decision, Governor Farris Bryant called on the legislature to enact a public defender law. "In this era of social consciousness," he said, and his words might have given Clarence Earl Gideon wry amusement, "it is unthinkable that an innocent man may be condemned to penal servitude because he is unfamiliar with the intricacies of criminal procedure and unable to provide counsel for his defense." Governor Bryant said the Gideon decision had made public defenders essential, not only to protect the innocent, but in order that valid judgments of guilty may be entered and criminals kept confined for the protection of society. He may have been thinking of all those inmates of the state prisons who had been tried without counsel and now might be entitled to new trials. In May 1963, barely 2 months after the Supreme Court had spoken, the Florida legislature approved a statute creating a public defender in each of the state's 16 judicial circuits. The four other southern states that had not provided counsel for non-capital defendants acted quickly to adjust to the new constitutional requirement. North Carolina's legislature passed a bill to have the state bar counsel and state Supreme Court draft rules for assignment of lawyers in all criminal cases, to authorize compensation of assigned counsel, and to appropriate $500,000 for initial expenses of the new system. In Alabama, Mississippi, and South Carolina, bar groups prepared rosters of lawyers available for assignment, and plans were drafted for legislation to compensate those appointed. Appraisals of the Gideon case in the South were surprisingly favorable. Howard McDonnell, the chairman of the Mississippi State Bar's Criminal Law Committee, told a meeting that the decision was far-sighted. He said, "Our penitentiary is loaded with inmates who are there because of no representation or improper representation." The head of the Wake County, North Carolina Bar Association, R. Maine Albright, said, "I think few lawyers would disagree with the principle enunciated by the Supreme Court. It was time we recognized the need for the defendant who is indigent to have a lawyer." Nor did the response to Gideon v. Wainwright come only from southern states. The Colorado legislature authorized counties in a local option statute to employ public defenders. Oregon created a public defender's office to handle appeals and other post-conviction proceedings by indigent prisoners. This was a specific response to the California case decided the same day as Gideon's, laying down the rule that indigents are entitled to lawyers on appeal also. The Minnesota legislature authorized compensation for lawyers representing indigents on appeal. New Hampshire and Vermont moved to strike from their statutes provisions, often ignored in practice, exempting crimes with lighter sentences from the counsel guarantee. Delaware's judges held a meeting to plan extension of the state's appointed counsel system to misdemeanor cases, in the apparent belief that the Gideon rule would sooner or later be extended to that level. "Without the Supreme Court," Gideon had told his visitor in the Florida penitentiary, "it might have happened sometime, but it wouldn't have happened in this state soon." The reaction to his case bore him out. For lawyers and legislators were taking steps that they recognized as requirements of justice, but that they had not taken without the nudge from the court. For its part, the court quickly made clear that it would apply continuing pressure to the states on the issue of the right to counsel. In the 3 months after the Gideon decision, during the remainder of the 1962 term, the justices set aside 31 lower court judgments and sent them back for reconsideration of prisoners' claims to counsel in light of the new rule. The cases came from 10 states: Alabama, Florida, Illinois, Louisiana, Maryland, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania. Among them was the case of Alan Baxley, Jr., the illiterate Florida prisoner for whom Gideon had drafted a petition. In April, the court unanimously reversed a Maryland conviction because the defendant had not had a lawyer at his preliminary hearing, at which he pleaded guilty. That decision made clear that counsel was constitutionally guaranteed not only at trial, but at any earlier proceeding, however brief or informal, at which the prisoner enters a plea. In response, the Baltimore Municipal Court, which holds preliminary hearings on criminal charges to be tried later in the higher courts, called an emergency meeting and obtained a pledge from the local bar associations to supply the needed lawyers. On the first business day of its next term, October 14, 1963, the Supreme Court began dealing with one of the difficult issues it had left undecided in Gideon, whether to apply the new counsel rule retrospectively to prisoners tried when Betts v. Brady was the law. 10 Florida prisoners convicted without the aid of counsel before March 18, 1963, petitioned for review of the Florida court's refusal to grant them writs of habeas corpus. In a brief order, the court granted the petitions, set aside the Florida judgments, and sent all the cases back to the Florida Supreme Court for further consideration in light of Gideon v. Wainwright. The justices had not themselves made the decision to apply the new rule retrospectively, but they seemed to be inviting the Florida court to do so. Justice Harlan dissented, saying the Supreme Court should have decided the issue itself. Florida went ahead and applied the Gideon rule retrospectively to all who had been convicted of felonies without counsel. The results were spectacular. By January 1, 1964, 976 prisoners had been released outright from Florida penitentiaries, the authorities feeling that they could not be successfully retried. Another 500 were back in the courts, and petitions from hundreds more were awaiting consideration. It will be an enormous social task to bring to life the dream of Gideon v. Wainwright, the dream of a vast, diverse country in which every man charged with crime will be capably defended, no matter what his economic circumstances, and in which the lawyer representing him will do so proudly, without resentment at an unfair burden, sure of the support needed to make an adequate defense. England already approaches that ideal. No poor man there is tried for at least a serious crime without the offer of counsel. Assignment in such cases is an expected part of a barrister's life, and he receives a fee from the state comparable to what a private client would pay in that kind of case. But England is, by comparison, a small and homogeneous society, with a simpler legal system and a much less serious crime problem. There is a long road to travel before every criminal court in the United States reaches the goal that appears on the facade of the Supreme Court building: equal justice under law. The new responsibilities imposed by the Gideon case on the bar and the courts will be heavy, but there is no sign that the American legal community regards them as unjustified. The president of the American Bar Association, Sylvester C. Smith, Jr., hailed Gideon and the Supreme Court's other criminal law decisions on March 18, 1963, as great advances in the administration of criminal justice in our country. Chief Justice Carlton Harris of Arkansas, speaking to the Conference of Chief Justices in 1963, said he had no fault to find with Gideon. The law as to the right of an indigent prisoner to counsel is now, for the first time, positively stated. In the record of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, Ernest Angell wrote, "In retrospect, the Gideon decision seems to have been long overdue." The St. Petersburg Times, a highly regarded newspaper in the state where Clarence Earl Gideon was tried and imprisoned without the help of a lawyer, rejoiced in his victory. "There will be those," the Times said, "who will decry the Supreme Court's softness toward persons accused of crimes." Ironically, many uttering such criticisms are the same ones who decry the ever-increasing size and centralization of government. "Most persons, we are sure, will be thankful that the Supreme Court clings to the ancient democratic tradition of protecting the individual against the tyranny of any governmental agency." The Washington Post said, Like the Gideon of old, who was summoned by an angel of the Lord to lead Israel and overcome the Midianites, Clarence Earl Gideon of Panama City, Florida, championed the cause of justice for all indigent defendants. It is intolerable, in a nation which proclaims equal justice under law as one of its ideals, that anyone should be handicapped in defending himself simply because he happens to be poor. Chapter 14. The case of Gideon v. Wainwright is in part a testament to a single human being. Against all the odds of inertia and ignorance and fear of state power, Clarence Earl Gideon insisted that he had the right to a lawyer and kept on insisting all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. His triumph there shows that the poorest and least powerful of men, a convict with not even a friend to visit him in prison, can take his cause to the highest court in the land and bring about a fundamental change in the law. But of course Gideon was not really alone. There were working for him forces in law and society larger than he could understand. His case was part of a current of history, and it will be read in that light by thousands of persons who will know no more about Clarence Earl Gideon than that he stood up in a Florida court and said, "The United States Supreme Court says I am entitled to be represented by counsel." That is the wonder of the law, that it moves case by case, seeking justice for each individual, but that any single case may be part of some larger movement. These great currents may not at first be perceived, even by those who set them flowing. When Justice Sutherland wrote about the right to counsel in 1932 in Powell v. Alabama, he must have had a sense of participation in a great event. He must have known that in holding unconstitutional the trial of the Scottsboro boys without adequate counsel, the Supreme Court was doing something it had never done before, setting aside a state criminal conviction because the procedure used to obtain it was unfair. But Justice Sutherland could hardly have imagined the scope of the constitutional revolution that was to follow Powell v. Alabama. The constitutional law of criminal procedure has been wholly transformed in the 3 decades since Powell v. Alabama. When the process started, a state law enforcement officer could say with confidence that there were virtually no limits in the federal constitution on how he went about his job, and virtually no chance that any conviction he won would be reversed by a federal court. Today, a pervasive system of constitutional restraints covers almost every aspect of state criminal law enforcement, from arrest through trial and sentence to appeal. All of these limits have been developed by the Supreme Court, case by case, from the vague words of the 14th Amendment, due process of law, and equal protection of the laws. Just as the Gideon case was part of a movement of the law on the right to counsel, and that in turn was but one aspect of the fundamental change taking place in the constitutional doctrine of fair criminal procedure, so the criminal law trend was part of a larger picture. In many other areas, the Supreme Court in the last generation has enlarged the dimensions of individual liberty. It was just 6 years after Powell v. Alabama when the court began to enforce the equal aspect of the doctrine allowing provision of separate but equal facilities for Negroes. Missouri must provide a legal education for Negroes within the state, the court held, not send them elsewhere. A dissent warned that the court's reasoning would eventually threaten the very institution of segregation, as it did. The decisions since have expunged the legal basis for racial discrimination in the United States, if not yet the actuality. Outside the racial area, the Supreme Court has developed in the last decades a whole panoply of new freedoms for the individual, to read what he wishes, speak what he will, join organizations without fear of governmental reprisal. Some, including Justice Black, have wished the court to go further in these directions, especially in protection against penalties for communist associations, but the overall movement remains libertarian in its direction. Most recently, in the reapportionment case, there has come the first promise of fair representation for the individual in his legislature. The unmistakable thrust of the court toward exaltation of the individual and restraint on governmental power over him has been met by the severest criticism, not least for the criminal law decisions. So much of this criticism is hyperbolic and uninformed that any serious observer is tempted to dismiss it out of hand. But there is good reason not to. Professor Louis L. Jaffe of the Harvard Law School wrote, "There will be, and there should be, popular response to the Supreme Court's decisions, not just the informed criticism of law professors, but the deep-felt, emotion-laden, unsophisticated reaction of the laity. This is so because more than any other court in the modern world, the Supreme Court makes policy, and it is at the same time so little subject to formal democratic control. It is in politics, and that in a democracy means that it must be prepared to withstand the angry howls of outraged citizens." Professor Jaffe's comment is a reminder of an easily forgotten truth, that the court must justify itself to every generation as one of the three great centers of power in the federal government. Why should 9 appointed lawyers play so large a role in a country that calls itself a democracy? Is it appropriate that the Supreme Court, rather than elected legislators, should reform the country's criminal procedure or its race relations? Those are the questions raised by Gideon v. Wainwright, or any other decision invoking the extraordinary power of the Supreme Court to measure the acts of other governmental agencies against the law of the Constitution and declare them void. In examining the wisdom of judicial review, it is important first to observe that democracy does not exist as a pure commodity anywhere in this country's governmental processes. State legislatures have long been notoriously unrepresentative of the voters because of distorted districts. In Congress, a handful of senior members from one-party districts hold vastly disproportionate power, and the Senate's rules allow a minority to block action. The point is not that pure democracy would be desirable. It is that the American system of government includes other elements, and one of them is the balancing power of the judiciary to intervene on behalf of individual freedom. The Supreme Court indeed often provides a forum for those, the despised and rejected, who have no effective voice in the legislative chamber. One example is Clarence Earl Gideon. "The poor man charged with crime has no lobby," Attorney General Kennedy has said. Enlightened opinion holds, without sentimentality, that treating criminal defendants in a decent way serves the interest of a civilized society. Yet legislatures, feeling no demand from the voters, will rarely do anything about unfairness in the administration of the criminal law except under pressure from the courts, or until the courts, especially the Supreme Court, generate a broad moral concern. The criminal law decisions of the Supreme Court have awakened significant forces in society to the moral considerations, and the result has been a fruitful interplay between court and legislatures. Certainly, the concern shown for the right to counsel in 1963 by the Kennedy administration, Congress, the Ford Foundation, and the many bar groups grew in large part out of the Supreme Court's decisions on the issue over 3 decades. The racial situation is an even more telling example of the court's function as a forum for those without a political voice. In some southern states, Negroes are virtually excluded from the political process. They carry no weight, less than no weight, in the legislatures. In that circumstance, is it undemocratic for the Supreme Court to intervene? Similarly, with the issue of legislative apportionment. The Florida legislature, which had long refused to provide counsel for the poor, was so inequitably districted that at the beginning of 1963, some 12% of the state's citizens could elect a majority of the members in both houses. In Florida, as in other states, a small rural minority had power and simply refused to give it up. Again, it must be asked whether there was not justification, democratic justification, for opening up avenues of judicial relief, as the Supreme Court did, so that the disenfranchised majority would have some way to break out of the cage. The court can, in fact, serve as a safety valve, relieving intolerable social pressures that build up when legislatures are unresponsive to urgent needs. Explosive as the racial situation is today, it might have been much worse if the Supreme Court, over the last half-century, had joined Congress and the Southern state legislatures in doing almost nothing to end racial discrimination. Nothing about the right to vote, to serve on juries, to use public facilities, to obtain an adequate, not to mention integrated, education. But the failings of our legislatures, state and national, are at best a negative justification for judicial power. The great role of the Supreme Court can only be justified in the end by the process it brings to bear on public problems, by the distinctive characteristics